Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
My mother had married him, and then she knew what he was when she married him. She brought this man into the home of two little girls who were around 8 or 9 when they met. You know, you just kind of really, like, I held on to a lot of anger about that for a very long time.
Jerelle Moody has been working her way up through the ranks of journalism for 25 years, through regional Queensland newspapers, reporting on everything from juvenile cancer to feline AIDS. She was old school, one story at a time, progressing to bigger towns and bigger papers, winning awards and being entrusted with bigger stories, never making herself the focus. Until 2014, when she finally recognised the importance of her own story of survival. And the Red Heart Campaign, and Australia's largest online memorial to women and children lost to violence, was born.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Since 2014, Jerelle Moody has been recognised as one of the most seriously, aggressively and threateningly trolled women in Australia because she dares to speak out about the epidemic of male violence in our country. We often talk about the terrible statistic of over a woman a week murdered in Australia, most under circumstances of domestic violence, by men who sometimes profess to love them. But less often spoken about is the fact that more than twice as many men are murdered every year in Australia. They're also killed, generally, by Australian men, although the circumstances are far more varied. So the evidence is clear. When it comes to violent death in Australia, the greatest single threat to men, women and children isn't sharks, it isn't African gangs, and it isn't Islamic terrorism. It's Australian men. That's just a fact. So how is it that so many Australian men and women feel justified in attacking people whenever we try to speak out about it? The statistics are clear. How can the denial be justified? Jerelle Moody and I have never met. We'd never spoken before this conversation, but as you'll hear, we begin this conversation in the middle, in the way people do when they've shared the brutal experience of being trolled online for the same thing. Hello. Hey, Cheryl.
Hey, this is Cheryl.
Cheryl. I'm sorry, I said Cheryl because I was just watching a video where a man calls you Cheryl. I was just waiting for you. I'm sure you know the one.
Yeah, no worries.
How are you?
Yeah. You?
Good, good. Thank you so much for calling. And
that's all right.
I'm sure we'll get to this bloke and many others as we go about our business.
Oh, my God, there's so many.
I know. It's so weird, isn't it? We will get to all of that because I've read a lot of your work in the last couple of days, and I just, as usual, I don't see where all the anger comes from.
Yeah, well, I think it just comes from men being angry that women are talking about this.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, really do. Yeah, okay. So you're based in southeast Queensland, and I lived in southeast Queensland for a long time.
You say southeast Queensland, it's probably a bit safer.
Do you find that men there are a bit more macho? When I lived there, honestly, and I grew up there, and I find men in southeast Queensland more macho than in some other parts of Australia, like, for example, inner city Melbourne. So I know that that does anger a lot of people in the southeast Queensland neck of the woods. Do you find that?
I think it's just uniform across Australia. I went to university in Toowoomba and lived there.
Yeah, that's
my
where I grew up.
At the Chronicle. Yeah, I remember moving to Melbourne and seeing something about the comedy festival. I think you were doing comedy festival way back when I was young as well.
Yeah, right. So do you find that or am I crazy?
Look, I find it's more, I just think the hate comes from everywhere, really.
Okay.
And look, most of the hate that I deal with is done electronically. The kind of that confrontational in-person hate is quite rare, and it might be because I insulate myself quite a bit, and also because the guys that I know and who are closely connected to me actually get what I'm talking about, so they're totally different people.
Although I must say that comments I made recently were very much directed at men who I know who are close to me, who are very much inner city latte sippers. When I said, when you say not all men, you're actually being really controlling and shutting down our conversation. I know some men who would consider themselves very much feminist allies who say to me, oh, but you know, I'm really sick of this. It makes me feel really guilty and I'm really sick of this war on men lately. And I think,
yeah.
I look at them and I think, oh, wow, now you consider yourself to be a really cool guy, and just because you're not violent and you don't think you're one of those guys, you're actually being really controlling right now and shutting down the conversation.
Yeah, that's totally not the kind of behaviour that you would expect from someone who's an ally. Or they say, you know, you've got to stop screeching. If you talk to us in a certain way, we might be more likely to listen to your message, and that sort of stuff as well.
This is so interesting because I was sort of talking along those lines. I have to say, after the Barry Hall joke, I was sort of trying to be conciliatory and saying, look, okay, I get it. Some of the terminology, even last week on the ABC radio, I was saying, okay, I get some of the terminology is really combative, because we had this big conversation on the radio about toxic masculinity. And I realized, oh, you all think that we're accusing you of being toxic. No, what we're saying is, the masculinity is toxic to you. It's poisoning you. It's hurting you. And I said, yeah, sometimes these terms feel so combative, you can't listen to us. And when we use terms together, toxic masculinity, rape culture, these terms are so harsh, they can't hear us anymore. Am I being too soft?
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like, when I write about this stuff, I explain what I mean, but it's like they just look at the headline and make that giant leap. They're not willing to listen to the argument, to take the argument on board. Look, if people come to me and say, hey, but what about women? They do it too. I am totally open to having that conversation, and I can give them the statistics and say, well, yeah, look, not as much as men, but yeah, it happens. But I am totally open to the conversation about why women do it, the women that do it, and how we deal with women not doing it again, so how we work to change that over a long period of time. You know, I'm totally open to that, and I'm very happy to have that conversation. But it's like men who get angry at these conversations don't want to talk about, you know, the small things that they can do to make change. I mean, we're not asking them to uproot their lives. We're just asking them to, you know, talk to their mates if they're being stupid or making rape jokes or doing locker room or, you know, look like they might be going to harm their partner and stuff like that. Not asking them to stop having testicles.
Nah, it's like any nuance is lost, isn't it? It just so quickly becomes this conversation of stupid extremes where it's like, hang on, can we get to nuances? Can we get to finer points? And No, hang on, we're all screaming again, and now we're into ridiculous points about calling each other names and saying we want each other dead. And
yeah, and then suddenly you're being told you should be raped and murdered by the very same person who's saying, but not all men, and stop man-hating, but hey, I wish you were raped and murdered.
I found that John Howard story so fascinating the other week, because I thought it was such an interesting opportunity and it just got squashed really quickly. So the story in the paper is, oh, how good's John Howard? He's a hero. He stopped a domestic violence attack in the street while he was going for his walk. And then read the second or third paragraph. Oh, it was actually the woman. He was standing in the street with the woman until the police came. Great. Hang on, it was the woman who broke the apprehended violence order. Okay, and the man was taken away to a psychiatric ward. And then, end of story. Stop talking about the story. All you need to know is John Howard was a hero. Okay, go away. Don't talk about it anymore. And I was like, okay, well, do you want us to talk about the domestic violence or not? Because it's obviously a really nuanced story. Okay, but now we're not allowed to talk about the story anymore.
No, we were only allowed to talk about John Howard. And honestly, why were we praising John Howard for doing something that every one of us should do, basically saying, hey, stop that? Scott Morrison's barely had a conversation about domestic violence or broader violence against women. The only kind of times his heads have really popped up was when that happened with John Howard and he proclaimed he was a hero. Mm. Also, you know, his photo op at the Bourke Street murder last year, and then another photo op at Aya's vigil location on the weekend. And, you know, in all that, he said, oh, we've given $350 million to domestic violence, but really, they've given an amount of money over a very long time that doesn't come anywhere near the amount that they give to terrorism. It's all about photo ops and funding proclamations, but really, there's just no leadership at that end of town at all on this issue.
And the point is made over and over again. If that many people, if that many Australians were eaten by sharks in a year, can you imagine the drama? Can you imagine the resources, the outrage that would go into killing every shark in the ocean?
For me, one of the most interesting conversations, I guess comparisons, that is going on at the moment is the very broad and long conversation about pill testing and drug death in comparison to the very short and sort of barely heard conversation about violence against women. So it sort of amazes me, and I don't like to take away from the deaths of people who've died as a result of taking drugs, but the reality is that they chose to take drugs. There was an inherent danger in that, and they died as a result. But here we have women sort of dying at significant rates in the last 12 months, and that is not their fault. They didn't do anything. It's the cause of another person's actions. But the conversations and the debates and, you know, the policy changes and the politics around both issues is vastly different. And it's really quite sad that we can't put violence against women up there with pill testing, I feel. Or shark attacks or strawberries or whatever else.
Strawberries.
Cricket balls.
It's been said to me before that every country has its blind spot, that America's blind spot is guns, and that we all stand on the outside saying, look how stupid they are. Look at these idiots. Why can't they see? It's so obvious. But we in Australia, our blind spot is domestic violence, family violence. Why can't we see it?
And the worst thing is that this is a conversation that we've been having for decades, for a century or more. This is not a conversation that is new. I research probably around 20 femicides a week from throughout Australian history, and the conversation is exactly the same time and time again. I don't know how many times I've read stories in the old Daily Telegraph archives or the Sydney Morning Herald archives where domestic violence campaigners are standing up and saying, hey, we need leadership, we need action, all of these women are dying. It's the same conversation over and over and over and over, and it's not changing.
And like you said, when we have drug deaths at festivals, look how hard we go on pill testing. When we had outrageous road deaths, look how hard we went on everything from seatbelts to modifications of cars to speed limits, advertising campaigns, and we brought the road deaths down, the road toll. And yet, where is all of that? Where is all of that motivation around the deaths of women in their homes, deaths of women at the hands of people who say they love them?
It's simply not there. It's there amongst women, you know, like us, or, you know, people who work at the front line all the time. Conversations being had, but it's just not getting through to people who can make change. And, you know, then we've got opinion writers and columnists who are kind of really going hardball on, you know, there's nothing wrong with guys, they don't have a violence issue and stuff like that, and that's really muddying the waters as well. And it just feels like you're in a vortex
all
the time.
It? And men who say it's not just women who are dying. And then you go back and say, no, it's not. But it's pretty much just men who are killing people. We have a violence problem and most of the offenders are men.
And most of the victims are men. So yeah. I count all murders and manslaughters. I counted them last year and I'm counting them this year. So this year we've had 13 deaths and 16 men have been charged in relation to those 13 deaths, no women, and one suspect gender is unknown. So that's 13 deaths in 21 days, and that's 16 men charged with murder in 21 days in Australia.
God.
There is clearly, no matter which way you look at it, this issue is gendered. If we tackle it from that gendered perspective, if we can get that down, then maybe we can work to get down the female perpetrators as well. The statistics are there, but people either don't want to see them or they just don't want to acknowledge it because obviously women do kill people and they just see it as something that should be dealt with uniformly. And it's being dealt with uniformly at the moment and it doesn't seem to be working.
The femicide map that you put together is heartbreaking. It's a map of Australia with, it looks like hundreds and hundreds of hearts on it. And when you click on the hearts, it brings up the story of a death. And just randomly you click on a heart. I've clicked on one here in Western Australia, Cara Hales, December 28th, 2018. 30-year-old Cara was killed in her home at Henderson Road, Munster, Western Australia. Jesse John Debeau, 23, is charged with her murder. And they just go on and on. Unnamed woman in Fitzroy Crossing, body of an unnamed woman. How is she still unnamed? It was her skeleton. Skeletal remains were found. Anne Newman found in Cooper Pedy, 1993, German tourist. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. What made you decide to put this map together?
I started the Red Heart campaign about 3 years ago and it was actually started to share stories of domestic violence survival, and over a matter of months that kind of changed to highlighting all violence against women and children regardless of perpetrator gender or relationship to the victim. For me, I have a really personal connection in terms of violent deaths. My stepfather, Barry Hadlow, killed Stacey Ann Tracy, who was 9 years old. Almost 30 years ago, it'll be 30 years next year.
After the break, Sherelle talks about the terrible day she realised her own mother had exposed her and her little sisters to a child killer. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we hear about the lengths to which Australia's so-called good guys will go to try to silence Sherelle Moody. But first, the terrible source of her determination to stand up for Australia's murdered women and children.
My stepfather, Barry Hadlow, killed Stacey Ann Tracy, who was 9 years old, almost 30 years ago. It'll be 30 years next year. And it always saddened me that, you know, when Stacey Ann's family dies, she has a sister and a mum, but after her sister dies, that's the end of the line for her. There'll be no one to remember her. And, you know, I've been really angry for 30 years, for maybe 27 or 28 years, like since it happened. And I just thought we need a memorial. So I built essentially a memorial online. So the Memorial to Women and Children Lost to Violence, which is hosted on the Facebook page. Then mid last year, I was looking at the Mexican femicide map. I just think it's an awesome project. And basically it's one woman who works under a pseudonym who documents every femicide in Mexico and puts it on a map. And I decided to lift everything from the memorial to an Excel database and made the femicide map. So that took quite a bit of work. It wasn't a very easy job to do. It actually took a couple of months to transfer everything across. there were about 450 deaths on the map at that stage, and at the end of this week I'll have put 1,700 femicides and child deaths on there. So it felt like the memorial was really good in terms of being able to see people's photos and read the stories, but it was just really hard to get people to connect with it, and I thought the map might have a better reach, which it did. It's been viewed 360,000 times since late July. So, and also because the map gives you a really good idea of what femicide and child deaths look like. You know, if you have a look at that, it's just New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria are just covered in hearts, and that's where most of the people are dying. It's just really about documenting their deaths and, I guess, giving their loved ones a place to remember them, but also giving the rest of our community a place where they can educate themselves about the type of violence that is taking so many lives.
Did you know, I'm just trying to get a timeline in your life about when you knew that your stepfather had murdered Stacey Anne. Had that happened before you met him?
No. So I met my stepfather when I was around 15. That was when my mother married him. She was introduced to him at a party in Toowoomba, and they got together very fast. I had four little sisters. I was 15, one was 14. My youngest sisters were probably around Stacey Anne's age when my mother and Barry met. They were together for 3 years. We knew he had a history, or he had a prison history, but we'd always been told that he killed a man in a fight and that he spent time in jail for manslaughter over that death. When I was 18, I went to Roma, which is where my family had moved to visit my sisters, and Barry picked me up the afternoon that I arrived. I sort of got off the bus and got straight into his car, and he was taking me home. And on the drive home, he was rabbiting on about this little girl who was missing. Oh. And anyway, the next day, like, I kind of, you know, when you're 18, you just think about your own shit and you don't really focus on anyone else's stuff. Anyway, the next day he got his SES uniform out and left my mother's house and went out to help search for Stacey Anne. And again, you know, you just kind of don't really take notice of what adults are doing when you're that young. A few days later, there was a knock on the door and I answered it, and there was a group of police, probably about 30 or so of them, milling around in the yard and detectives handing me warrants. And they said they were there to speak to Barry and were searching the house. And they took Barry out of the house, and my mother and myself and my sisters sat down, and that's when they said, oh, we're investigating Barry because we believe that he abducted and murdered Stacey Anne. So, yeah, it was pretty confronting and a real shock. So they kind of went through their processes, and a couple of days after, when they first searched the house and seized the car, I was at the police station for another reason, and the detectives said, can you just come into this room and have a look at a couple of items that we found? And I went in there, and there were items from my mother's house that were easily recognisable. They'd been found with Stacey Anne's body. So I became a witness for the prosecution at that stage. Anyway, I was sitting out on the back step of the Roma police station after they'd arrested Barry. He was in the jail cells, and you could see into the watch house from the back steps of the cop shop. And I was sitting there with one of the detectives, and that's when she said, well, you know, Barry had served time for killing another little girl. And that's when the story came out for me. And it was just like, you know, it was like being punched in the face, basically. That this person had not only killed a child before, but that my mother had married him, and then that she had known his history. She knew what he was when she married him.
Are you sure?
And yeah, for sure. Didn't take long to come out that she knew what his history was. She married him. She knew he was on parole for raping and murdering Sandra Bacon in Townsville, And she brought this man into the home of two little girls who were around 8 or 9 when they met. So the next few years was pretty, it's hard to, like, traumatic, I guess is the best way to say it. Barry was eventually convicted of Stacey Ann's murder and rape, and he was locked up with his file marked never to be released. And he died around, I think it was around 2007, would be my guess that he died. I can't quite remember. But anyway, he's dead now. You know, you just kind of really, like, I held on to a lot of anger about that for a very long time.
Were you active as a feminist and all of those things before that?
No, not at all. Like, yeah. I was very young, and I was already really sort of living life fairly precariously because my mother was very violent, so I grew up surrounded by violence. I spent a lot of time in foster homes and in group homes and stuff like that. And so life was really shit up until that point. And then, you know, it just gets worse because you kind of feel like even though it's not your fault, even though you have nothing to do with it, you kind of spend your life feeling guilty for her family. Like, you just feel so guilty for Stacey Ann. You feel guilty for her mum and her sister. She had a little sister. And, you know, you just carry that guilt around. And the thing is that when a person is murdered, there is a lot of support for that person's family, but there's actually no support for the family of people who kill. You know what I mean?
I really do.
And so, I was very lucky in terms of one of the police officers who investigated Stacey Ann's death has become a dear friend over the ensuing years, and she was always very patient and very helpful with me, but she was basically the only support that I really had. I think I just got to a point where I was sick of really being angry about this, and I decided that there was a point where you have to do something to just funnel that anger, and that's pretty much where the femicide map comes from.
Well, I guess journalism first, right? Was that where journalism came from, where you wanted to tell stories and, you know, report and help other people tell their stories?
Because I dropped out of school when I was 15, so I went back to school and did year 12, and I applied for law because that's where I thought that I would make the most difference. And journalism was my second option, and I got accepted into law in Brisbane but couldn't afford it. So I took the offer at the university in Toowoomba. I was very intrigued about the reporting of the case. I guess that kind of fed into it. In a way, I fell into it by accident, but I also thought about the way that the case was reported and, you know, that sort of mystique that surrounded the newspapers and the media coverage at the time.
Where did your relationship with your mum end up? Is she still living?
My mother's still alive, and I haven't spoken to her for 25 years, I would say.
What about your sisters?
I have a very fractured relationship with my sisters, but it probably stems from the fact that we just had a really, our childhood was very horrific, and it's very hard to bond in that situation. But my mother's still alive, and well, she didn't divorce Barry until quite a few years after he was convicted. She stood by his side throughout the trial. She was a vocal supporter of him for quite a long time, and she never believed that he killed Stacey Ann. There are media reports from the time where she's quoted as saying that, you know, it wasn't him and that sort of stuff.
Is there someone in your life now who takes care of you, Sherelle?
Well, my partner, but I don't know if it's like taking care. I do have a partner. And
I'm sure you're not easy to take care of after all this. I mean, you must be, you know, like so incredibly independent. To be honest with you, I'm so fucking angry, and I just feel like, do all of these people who troll you have any idea what you have survived, and how fucking dare they make their little videos for YouTube and their little Facebook videos accusing you of everything from misandry to fucking Christ knows what? And I just think, do they have any idea what you have survived and what you have done for other people? And I'm so angry.
Look, I think that it wouldn't matter if they knew every bit of detail about me. And, you know, like my relationship to Barry is not something that's a secret, and my childhood is not a secret either. But the reality is, it doesn't matter to these people. What matters is they just see me as needlessly highlighting male violence and making men look bad. Basically, trolling for me happens in waves. The first wave I got was when I started the Red Heart campaign, and it was like, oh my God, what is this shit? You know, I'd never experienced this kind of, you know, mass hysteria directed at me before. And then that kind of calmed down, and then Bloke's Advice had members inciting their followers to rape and harm women, and I kind of went on a bent to get Facebook to shut that group down. And then the trolling was pretty bad, you know, there were death threats and threats of violence and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, it eases off after a week, and so you go back to that really calm moment. But interestingly, when the femicide map launched, within 24 hours of me saying the map was live, Blokes lost it. They lost it more than you could possibly expect anyone to lose it. Everyone from, like, even Mark Latham was in on it. They were just appalled and shocked that I dared to put all of these women's lives onto a map. They just couldn't handle it. So, yeah, it was pretty relentless. I had death threats on my mobile phone, on my message bank, on, you know, through social media. My dog was poisoned.
No!
It was a really shit time. Can you believe that, like, something
by all these people,
so simple,
by the way, wanting to prove that you're lying about men's violence?
Yeah, I know. And they're like, well, hold on, you're not highlighting female violence. And I'm, well, actually, the map contains victims of violent deaths at the hands of both gender. And yes, you know, you're probably looking at about a 50% ratio of male and female perpetrated violence against children on the map. The map doesn't shy away from that. It doesn't matter who killed the woman or the child. Mm. What matters for me is putting their story on there and making sure that, you know, that they're commemorated, even if we don't know their name. There's no use even trying to communicate with these people. And, you know, they'll say to me, well, why don't you talk about female violence more? And I do talk about female violence, but the reality is that most of the violence that I talk about is current, and of course it's going to be more focused on men because men are just doing these violent acts at higher rates than women. I think last year's deaths, around 85% were male perpetrated.
Well, God, thank you so much. Just thank you for everything, Sherelle. You're amazing. You're a warrior.
And thanks.
Take it from someone who's given up so many times because I can't hack it. I can't hack it. And I've lived through so much less than you, and that's probably why I can't hack it. I'm just not as tough as you. And I just thank you so much. And thank you so much for this conversation. And we salute you, my friend.
No worries. Thanks, mate. Thanks for having the discussion. And can you send me a note when it's online, and I'll do a promo?
Yeah, you bet. I'll do anything for you. I'll do anything for you, Sherelle. Anything in the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
mate,
for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime.
Bye.
And thank you to Sherelle Moody for her courage. Thank you also to every Australian man who's ever stood up to another man's mistreatment of a woman.